Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Tim, and this is Get On Board,
a podcast about games worth playing.
Welcome to Get On Board, a podcast about games worth playing. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about the way that we review the games worth playing. We've done a little bit of this before. We've done some analysis on board game reviewers and how they review and how we want to review. But we wanted to talk a little bit today about something that you may have noticed if you listened to our last podcast, where we did two reviews of Deception, Murder in Hong Kong and Hive, that we talk about board game moments in terms of magic and tragic.
Right.
And something that we're committed to is doing things in a way that really inform you most about why we love the games. And we want to do this in a way that's just more than just your standard pro and con. So let's talk a little bit about why we chose these terms, magic and tragic, and what it is that we're sort of after as we review a game, you know, in this section. We also want to talk a little bit about, and we would actually really like to get some of your feedback on this, about something that we decided to purposely exclude from our reviews.
For the most part.
We should talk about that part first.
That part first?
Yeah, bring it in, Andrew.
Okay, well, so basically we were just talking and we mentioned, you know, oh man, when I listen to or watch a review, I just usually skip the game overview part. It's just not interesting for me. You know, usually I'm seeking out a game that I'm interested in anyways. So A, either I already know that, or B, I've gotten that information somewhere else. And really, I just want to hear a reviewer's final thoughts. I want to hear their opinion on the game. So I guess we could phrase it as a question. Why do so many reviewers start with that 10 to 15 minutes of explaining the game, basically?
And this is something that baffles me. You know, I very often see a board game reviewer on Board Game Geek. I will occasionally see a board game review on Board Game Geek say, you know what, I'm going to skip a normal overview and just get to the points. Almost always somebody in the comments will say, you know, it would have been really helpful if you'd had an overview. And I'm thinking, why?
You can't please them all.
Every other text review before you had an overview, every other video review before you had an overview. It's sort of like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of a good analogy for this in another product. But, you know, in a product where everybody kind of knows how it works,
right?
Do you really need to explain that? Do you really need to explain the mechanics of how the controller on the latest and greatest video game system works? Or do you just want to go right into its, you know, the features that really make it stand apart?
Right.
Yeah, I get it. Board games are, you know, a lot more complex and varied than that. I get it. But anybody else listening just sort of always skip the I don't fully skip them. Mm-hmm. I kind of like hit just a spot or two to see sort of what the game looks like and
right.
Get an idea of what the core mechanic is. But I would rather listen to more than 30 seconds of the board game overview.
And I will say the one place I find them helpful, if you are reviewing an obscure game or a game where you are one of a few reviews
right.
For that game, sure, you want to give a little bit more perspective. I think of that Reiner Knizia game Polynesia, which only reached publication in Russia. It only has three owners on Board Game Geek. You know, if anyone's interested in that game, which doesn't look like there are many people who are, you're going to want a little bit of an overview in any review of that game.
Right.
But aside from that one edge case, you know, I just don't really see a need for this. And honestly, guys, the Dice Tower is performing the encyclopedia role for this hobby pretty well.
Right.
I don't really see a need to do reviews in that vein because that's the first place I look if I'm looking for a basic overview of the game and a short final thoughts segment. And I trust Tom's judgment on a lot of the games that he reviews. So the Dice Tower is already doing it quite well. And I would say they have that niche kind of locked down in a similar way to how Rotto has the playthrough locked down and how Rodney Smith has the rules explanation kind of settled. Not to say that competition with those guys is a bad thing or that we can't have any change, but I mean, come on. I was looking into the game Lisboa this week and I listened to five or six reviews and they all started that exact same way. You know, well, I'm going to give you an overview of the mechanics. And I was really there for the opinion, and I skipped to the end, and I got 2 minutes of opinion, and I just kind of thought, well, So I've listened to 6 reviews, but none of them have really told me how they actually feel about this game.
Especially, and this is going to be really cynical, especially with some of the smaller reviewers or the one-off reviewers that I'll see, sometimes what they say is exactly the same as every other reviewer is saying, and I'm thinking, what have you added to this?
Right.
So if you had instead thought about how the game made you feel, the experience you personally had with the game, and told me about that, that would be something different, right?
Right.
And that's what I look for. You know, listening to you talk about the Dice Tower and their, you know, what they bring to the hobby, why do I listen to another review outside of Tom Vassell's when mm-hmm. I respect him so much? Because Tom doesn't always like the same kinds of games I like. He may not react to the game in a way that I react to it. And he himself will say, I'm not criticizing him for this, but he doesn't play those games more than maybe 1 or 2 times each before he reviews them. In most cases, he just doesn't have time to. He reviews so many games, you cannot possibly do that. So sometimes it's good to get an opinion from somebody who's played the game more, who maybe is more similar to your taste. And there have been those times where I found that one reviewer who says, you know, everybody's going crazy about this one, but I kind of see a problem here.
Right.
And sometimes that person is right.
Right.
And that's only going to come from people really speaking to their personal experience with the game. And that's what Magic is all about. Magic is about those moments where we interacted with a game and just really, it just really zinged us. It just really gave us a cool moment of experience that we took away from that and we're going to remember. And I don't need to explain the entire game. And I don't need to have an entire game explained to me to say, hey, listen to this one moment.
This is really cool.
This is really cool.
Right.
I don't need to understand the mechanics of the game front to back to relate to that really cool moment that you just described to me.
Now, a short overview is good. You know, we had the luxury of, in Deception and Hive, we had very simple games, so it was easy to give a 1-minute overview of them. But, you know, a short overview is helpful so that when you then go in to talk about the magic moment, your audience knows what terms you're using.
Right.
The basic, very basic, like 20,000 foot view of the game. But I agree. You know, when I look at a game that I'm interested in, I really want to know how it made people feel. And there are so many ways to do this better than just kind of the generic overview. Some guys I've been listening to are the Secret Cabal Gaming Podcast, and they've got 5 guys on their podcast. And so you can bet that you're getting a wide spectrum of opinions on any one game. And that's interesting. Yeah, that's far more interesting.
5 guys. Man, can you imagine if we had to split the money that we make 5 ways?
Oh, man.
We'd
eat even less ramen.
Wow. So for you, like when you say magic moment, are you thinking something that you'll take away from that game like forever? Because that puts it at a really high standard. Or are you just kind of going for that, you know, this game kind of zinged me here at this point. How is a magic for you different from just like a general pro?
Right.
And, you know,
pro, I think of more broadly. I don't think of, a pro of this game is that it made me feel this way this one time. Mm-hmm. A pro is something more general about the game. Like Lancaster, for example. A pro would be, this has a lot of player interaction for a midweight Euro. A magic moment would be, bro, do you remember that one time when John Adams was on the 4 knight spot and I totally just shoved him off with every last squire I had? You know, so there's a difference there. There's a little bit of difference there. And I think we can talk about both as reviewers. But ultimately what I'm interested in is those magic moments. And those don't have to be like all-time best gaming moments.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, not every game will have them. Right. But when they do, I definitely want to mention them. A lot of my favorite games are the ones that I can tell stories about.
And because we do want to be a bit picky on this podcast, and we've talked about this before, because we want to be a little bit critical of mediocre games in a market that is flooded with mediocre to good games, I think for us to recommend a game, it's going to have to really have that magic moment.
Yeah,
we're really just going to have to blanketly say, if we're going to blanketly say this is a good game for almost everyone, then it's going to have those moments in it.
And I could see us reviewing both games that have a a high concentration of magic moments and a high concentration of tragic moments, which are kind of, you know, the opposite. And if a game has that many of them, it's something I would want to talk about to ward people away.
Right.
But I would say, I think there are some games that just by their nature are not prone to this. Abstracts come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love abstracts, but I think Photosynthesis or even Hive or Twixt or Go, they're less prone to that, aha, you know, they're good in a different way. So I'm kind of struggling to wrap my mind around that. You know, is that just inherent to the genre, or am I just thinking about it wrong? But I don't know. I don't know if all games will necessarily meet this qualification.
Yeah, well, I would say here that abstracts are easy to review because we can just label the entire genre as tragic. I'm messing with you, man. I'm messing with you.
You know, Shakespeare's tragedies are better than his comedies. So maybe my abstracts are actually better than every other game, just like Shakespeare.
I'm going to get some hate mail on that. I don't hate all abstracts. I do love some abstracts. Listen to our Hive review, but I don't love them in the way that you do. You can really see some magic in some games.
This might be a good place to inject the fact that I just bought on eBay a Kazakh abstract called Tokus Kumlak, which means nine apricots, I think, and it's a Moncala variant that I'm very excited about. It's shipping to me from Kazakhstan, so expect my review on that in about 6 months.
I'm a nerd, and I'm going to say this. Nerd! Wow!
My dedication outstrips even yours.
Wow.
Nothing gets my blood stirring like a really good abstract.
Oh, yeah? Well, I have an abstract that was originally played with the toenails of chimpanzees. You know what? Maybe we should edit that out.
I would play that game.
You would? Okay, so tragic. For me, I would agree that tragic is, like, when we bring up tragic moments in games, and I'm thinking of one that we just played the other day, and I'm not ready to review it. And I'm going to say that thing that I said that I hate when people say. It has some really cool magic, but, I wanted to like it. It's just, the tragedy is that it has those tragic moments.
You need to name the game where people are going to turn it off.
Gekido Bot Battles.
Oh, Gekido Bot Battles. Under every miniature, there's a good game. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Man, I feel about Ameritrash the way you feel about Abstract.
It's so close. It's so close. And the minis are beautiful. It's like, imagine King of Tokyo, but coming with really cool minis and a much smarter game underneath that just barely misses the mark. Anyway, but I've only played it twice, so I need to give it the full five.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Before I really declare it as tragic. Well, any other thoughts on Magic Tragic before I move off the topic?
I have one quick thought on tragic, and I've wrestled with this. You know, does a tragic moment mean that the game was aggressively bad? I mean, I'll bring up our favorite punching bag, Treasure Hunter, by Richard Garfield. Does a game need to be glaringly bad for us to surface it as something to avoid? Or does it just need to be thoroughly meh? You know, I think Gekido, for example, is a game that I would class as meh. I don't have strong feelings about it one way or the other. Even Treasure Hunter, I would put that way, you know, and I would contrast that with something like a game that has a fatal game-breaking flaw that actually makes it not playable or not any good. But maybe the greater tragedy is a game that is 75% good and just doesn't have that extra lick of polish that makes it stand out.
That's how I feel about Gekido so far. Mm-hmm. Treasure Hunter, I would say, wasn't so big a letdown because it wasn't so big an expectation to begin with.
That's just one of those games where you open the box and you say, "Yeah, why did they put time into this?"
Right.
That sounds really harsh, but honestly, I mean, that game is aggressively bland.
From a big name designer too, so mm-hmm. I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily. I almost think those are the kinds of games that we are not going to be giving airtime to.
Right.
I guess they might come up in our recent plays.
Right.
When we sort of just mention them, but
well, at the risk of just name dropping a bunch of games that we might plan to review in the future, I would definitely pull out Sagrada as a game that makes that I would label tragic, because for me, the magic moment of that game was, wow, this is a really unique theme. It's a very accessible, you know, dice drafting game. It looks really interesting. But then I played it, and no matter what I did, I was always a couple points ahead or behind. And the accessibility was focused on so much that the game's just not actually interesting at all.
It actually takes a lot of discipline as a reviewer, and this is what I'm finding, even this far into the game. It takes a lot of discipline to open a box that you really like the presentation, mm-hmm. you really like the idea, where you see that the designers have done something innovative mm-hmm. that hasn't necessarily been done before or in that particular way. It looks great. It feels great. It's got some great creative energy behind it, and it falls short. Right. Those are the hardest ones for me to call.
Well, to circle back to your I wanted to love this trope, maybe our sentiment on these games could be, I would play the mess out of a version 2 of this. And maybe that's what it needs. Maybe it needs a different yeah. publisher or a different designer to just take that spin on it. And maybe that's what it takes. Maybe some of these games that were just unfinished or just had some good ideas but lacked in execution, maybe we will see them refitted, re-put together into a more interesting package somehow. I don't know.
I'm trying to think of, have I seen a game fixed, like radically fixed by a version 2.0? That'll be a question for another podcast, maybe.
Yeah.
Offhand, sure. I'm not jumping on one that I'd say the 2.0 just completely overhauled it in such a beneficial way. I agree. And maybe that's what I would say about a Sagrada and a Gekido. Circle back around, polish yeah. some of that up, streamline yeah. it. Don't give up on this idea. It's a right. really good idea. It's just not quite there.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure.
Well,
Asmodee.
Now, what did you do when you heard that name? Did you cringe?
Well, how does it make you feel when I tell you that I actually read just this morning that they've actually acquired Rebel, the Polish publisher Rebel as well?
Wow.
So they are aggressively corporatizing everything under their bland logo. But actually, I don't have strong feelings towards Asmodee one way or the other. What we want to talk about a little late to the party is the interview that was released with Christian Peterson and another Asmodee employee whose name escapes me at the moment. But this interview has kind of made some waves on Board Game Geek and on some of the podcasts that we listen to. And the gist of the article was these two board game executives basically exposing the extent of piracy that's happening in the industry. And it's kind of gotten a mixed reaction because Asmodee, they don't have a ton of friends right now. You know, it's easy to paint them as the evil corporate overlords who love acquiring publishers. And I would love to hear your thoughts on this, because basically some of the assertions they made are pretty bold. They said, you know, for some of our games, up to 70% of them are pirated copies. They talked about the burden on their logistics chain that it is to fulfill replacements for these. They talked about how expensive it is to ship replacement parts out, the effect it has on their image. I mean, I think this is a pretty significant problem that's facing the industry right now. And to be honest, I don't think it affects only the big players. I think eventually this will come to affect everyone, because I think as more money enters the industry, this will become a more attractive target.
So what I'm trying to do right now is what I would encourage our listeners to do right now as you think about this topic. Put aside for a moment how you feel about Asmodee. Because it's easy to bash the big guy.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, I don't think the story has yet been written as to whether the Asmodee conglomeration is good or bad for the... whether we'll look back on it and say it was a good thing or a bad thing.
You guys should totally reprint Russian Railroads. Please.
Oh, yeah. And see, well, and that's... Okay, you just caused me to take a little rabbit trail. That's where I've sort of cringed a little bit. When we see these incredible games just sort of get... The feet start dragging on the reprinting, because the bigger this behemoth gets...
Arboretum, please.
Yeah, it's like there's been a lot of demand for that game. Yeah. What in the world? I don't get it. But let's put aside our feelings about Asmodee for a second and talk about... Because I think kind of at core, the core issue is, are the games so expensive that that's what really drives the counterfeiting in the first place?
I think a lot of people got the tone from the article which I didn't read into it, but I think people did read this, you know, poor us, you know, gamers just want to save a buck and they'll buy the cheapest thing and they have no discernment. I didn't get that tone from the article at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were talking about a problem which confronts the industry. I think gamers can be prone to wait for sales. I mean, I wait for sales. I think gamers can be prone to buy Amazon when it's cheaper than anything else.
Want to be fair, now granted, it's not their more popular titles, but every year Asmodee puts on a killer sale, typically pre-Black Friday, and they only run it for a few days, and oh my gosh, they clear out stuff cheaply. I end up spending way more on those sales than I should. But in general, they're holding to higher MSRPs. And
so what do you think about their assertion that 70% of some of their games are pirated?
Okay. My initial response is no way. That's just Microsoft crying foul. that's like Microsoft, you know, claiming that Ubuntu is cutting significantly into their market share. The thing, though, that I'm falling back on is anecdotal evidence for me. Right. I bought a counterfeit game accidentally from Amazon, and it said fulfilled by Amazon. I didn't pay attention to the seller. I really should have. And I remember after I bought it while I was on a trip overseas. I wasn't going to be back for a few months, but the price hit such a good point that I just went ahead and had it shipped to my address while I was gone, and somebody was going to pick it up for me. And when I opened the Amazon box, not even when I opened the game, it was so disappointing. The sides were kind of, the box is cheaply made. The sides were dished in. Even the internal insert was warped. It was really hard to even get the lid off the box. And the card, the color quality of the cards was awful. The size of the cards was a little bit different. Yeah, and the even one of the cards was misprinted, just in terms of it didn't have the 6+, 7+, like Seven Wonders cards have, where it shows you what number of players. It was missing that completely. So I was really, really disappointed, and I called Amazon. And I guess that was the second point of disappointment for me. Amazon acted like they were oblivious to, oh, well, that's really interesting. Wow, yeah, I've never heard of that happening before. Well, are you sure it's counterfeit? Well, we'll honor it, but it just doesn't seem, you know. They acted like incredulous, but I saw the complaints afterwards from that seller. There were a number of people reporting.
Well, things have ramped up in the past year. I doubt Amazon would say that now. Although Amazon has done very well. I feel like there's two types of scams. You know, the one type you'll see a seller who's just launched and they're selling, Fury of Dracula 3rd Edition for $13.
Okay.
And you say, okay, that's almost definitely a scam. And aside from a few unfortunate souls, I feel like board gamers have been pretty good at identifying those, avoiding them, and contacting Amazon and shutting those down. And those pop up and they're gone.
Right.
Copies are more insidious because of the way Amazon does its inventory, where any seller that's fulfilled by Amazon, all of that inventory goes to the same warehouse. And so they don't know, you know, they just trust those sellers equally. And so if one of them happens to acquire bad merchandise, you know, that just gets mixed in with all the legitimate stuff. And then that just becomes a huge logistics problem for the publisher, not to mention a public image problem. If you had not known better, if you had bought it as a Christmas present and you open Seven Wonders and you say,
so embarrassing.
Oh, this is the way that they make the game. That's a problem, you know? And even, you know, we're talking about Amazon. I think they have a fair share of the blame here. But if you go to other platforms like eBay, where the oversight is even laxer, go look on eBay, folks. Go look up some of these popular games. There are plenty of listings on there that I'm pretty sure are counterfeit copies. Now, I have no proof. I'm not going to bother to spend my own money on that. But there's some shady stuff happening here. And I think it's because of the influx of money into the hobby. I think it's gotten big enough that it's attracting attention in the wrong ways.
Well, I'll tell you again, this is just everything I'm saying right now is factual. This is not conjecture because it was my own experience with Amazon. But after I got hit with that counterfeit game and the hassle of having to call them and get a return shipment authorization and everything, I mean, I don't like messing with that stuff. I don't have time for that. I kind of got the impression of Amazon, like, they were that sort of, they're becoming sort of that outdoor market that sells Yeah, or Adidas shirts, but you have no idea if they're the real deal or counterfeit, and they're probably counterfeit. But, you know, it felt seedy to me.
Yeah.
And Amazon sort of, I would have sure felt a lot better if Amazon had said, we want to know what seller it was. We're gonna be contacting the seller. Look, we're committed to getting you quality products. We're committed to honoring, you know,
right.
That something like that would have made me feel a lot better. But it was just sort of that, well, wink, wink, you know, these things happen. Hey, we'll just return it. You know, no big deal. It is a big deal. It is a big deal to me.
Right.
And I've become very suspect of the stuff I buy off of Amazon.
Yeah, actually, I've started buying some of my games at friendly local game stores, and, you know, even online, Miniature Market, Cool Stuff, Inc. Now, granted, I have the Amazon Prime membership, so it's still, in some cases, more cost-effective for me to buy on Amazon, but it's given me that note of pause, which is significant. You know, I consider myself a pretty big Amazon fan, but yeah, I think they have some accountability in this, and I would love to see, you know, some of these bigger players like Asmodee. You know, they're the only ones with any sort of muscle to exert pressure on Amazon. I think that's the only way you'd see this change. That or just thousands and thousands of complaints from people, which I don't think we'll see that volume.
So back to the Asmodee issue then, back to the Asmodee question. I really tend to stick up for them on this, and that's hard for me to spit out of my mouth.
No, I won't give them any flack for this one, I don't think.
You're talking to a guy who... Well, I ranked Nations as my number one game. I absolutely love that game, and that's part of the Asmodee umbrella, and it retails for $90 when it should not retail for more than half of that, in my opinion, based on the component quality. And I mean, I have some real issues with the pricing and presentation of that game. It's fortunate that I love the gameplay so much. But all that to say is I do have issues with Asmodee. I do have issues with how they price. I do have issues with how they're buying up smaller, agile, more creative publishing houses and kind of absorbing them into this slow-moving behemoth. I do have issue with the fact that it seems to me that a lot of really innovative games that aren't as profitable as some of their big-name cash cows are going to get sort of neglected and thrown to the side. I have issues with all of that.
I think they're doing a decent job with that. Now, granted... Most of the stuff that Asmodee sells is not up my alley. Most of their sub-publishers are not ones that I use a ton. I would say the biggest one that I do buy games from is Z-Man Games. This is all conjecture. I am in no way saying this in any authority. I wonder about Z-Man, though, if they're a special case. You know, we mentioned Arboretum and Russian Railroads. I wonder if there's some internal stuff going on there specifically that we're not privy to.
Right.
Because they do give these companies, you know, obviously they keep their brand and they use some of Asmodee's marketing muscle. But for the most part, these are the same teams they were before they got acquired. So I don't know if Z-Man in particular has like a brain drain or something like that going on, some sort of internal issue that they're working through. But it does just seem like they've lost some of the spark since they've been acquired.
You see, but if...
But I wouldn't necessarily blame Asmodee for that, because I think there are other publishers that they've acquired that are doing fine. So I don't know. That's all conjecture. Take it for what it's worth.
Anything else I would say about Asmodee, I've probably already said, you know, a lot that is conjecture. But I don't think that it is conjecture to say that when you have a company that is acquiring other companies, you do sort of have the issue that you've got to handle scaling well. Right. And is Asmodee really able to take advantage of economies of scale? And their pricing structure would so far indicate not really.
Well, I'm going to give them a couple more years. That's my official stance. I, you know, it's hard to integrate companies for one thing. And if they really are working hard to integrate something like marketing departments, if they're working to trim down the unnecessary and add more where they can, you know, because of the economies of scale, we're not going to see the fruits of that until, you know, a couple more years down the road, I think. I don't know.
But in the meantime, I'll tell you what I've done. I've stopped buying some of their games. Yeah. Or I've avoided purchasing some of their games just because of where they're priced. I love Raw. I would love to buy Raw.
You're killing me.
But, I mean, my gosh, I mean, pretty much everywhere you look, look at it, it's up there close to their MSRP. It doesn't seem to go on sale. Yeah. I'm just kind of given up on buying that. And
that's an area I'd love to see them be more consistent. You know, they have Through the Desert, Ra, Samurai. They're all by different imprints. They're all somehow in the Euro Classics line. They had Wind Rider games, then they acquired Z-Man, so they shuttered Wind Rider games. But if you buy Ra, it doesn't yet have Z-Man games' logo on the cover, but Through the Desert will have Z-Man games' logo.
I'm getting dizzy.
I'm a little tired of all these random imprints that are actually the same company. Plan B Games recently announced Next Move Games, which is kind of their accessible abstract line. So Azul is moving over there, and then they're also launching Reef. And they also acquired Eggert Spiel, and they will be keeping that as a separate brand. So now all of a sudden, Plan B Games, which today had three games, they now have three imprints.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little confusing to me as a consumer, and I don't understand the industry well enough to, but it's confusing. It's a little confusing. So we'll see what the next few years bring with Asmodee specifically.
Ask me if I have good news.
Do you have good news?
I have great news.
What's your great news?
I just got an email today.
Okay.
That Dominant Species hit the mark on the P500, and it's going to get shipped out soon.
Nice.
So, yay! After That's a year exciting. Of signing up on GMT Games P500, I realize a lot of our listeners don't know what I'm talking about right now, maybe. So, and I think it's a great segue because it goes from a company that I'm not wild about right now to a company that I think just does such a great job of listening to their customers. GMT doesn't sit there and guess, gee, what do our customers want? They let you vote. They say, hey, look, place the order. We won't charge the credit card until the game gets 500 orders. As soon as it gets 500 orders, we'll send this thing off to print. We'll charge you, and you'll have it within a certain amount of time. They're great at communicating. They're great at listening to their customers. They're great at making really clever, thinky games. They're not always great at making them look great.
Yeah.
That's the only problem I have with GMT.
Although I will say, they have a game out called Pendragon, The Fall of Roman Britain.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
It's a war game by GMT Games. And if you know me at all, that's about as far away from a game I'd be interested in. But it's got that historical theme that I'm interested in. And it actually looks pretty dang attractive. I was really grabbed by it. I was surprised because, yeah, I've kind of had that stereotype about GMT Games. Oh, yeah, well, shame about the looks. But they've got some better-looking ones out there.
I think it's easier for me to ignore that. I think GMT is a company. They're the only game company I'm in danger of falling in love with. I mean, just really loving the company I think they're the only game company, and they're going to watch out for me now at the next Gen Con, you know, where if I walk by their booth, I would just, like, hug a random person there and say thank you.
Because that'd be one surprise volunteer.
Because, you know, we all sit around when games that we've been eyeing are out of print, we all sit around going, you know, why don't they bring this back into print? Everybody said it was a great game. And GMT says, hey, look, we're not arguing with you. We need 500 people who don't have this game to say it's a great game by ordering it.
Right.
And then we get it to you. And that's just so clear. It's so simple. It removes crowdfunding and Kickstarter. I mean, in a way, it's sort of like crowdfunding.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to prepay. So it's, I don't know, it's the best of every world for the consumer. And it's great for GMT games. And I just, GMT, hats off to you guys. I'd like to
see some other publishers experiment with that. I think it limits their growth to an extent. I mean, none of those games are going to take off and be the next blockbuster, but they clearly have their niche and they're working it pretty well. I think that could be valuable. And for these lesser known titles that are not as popular, say, hey, we'll reprint it when 1,000 of you guys get pumped about it.
Right.
When 1,000 of you put down, you know, a deposit or something to pre-order it or what have you, you know, that's pretty cool.
Everybody's screaming at Z-Man for, you know, not reprinting the expansion to Clash of Cultures, for instance. And they've said, no, we're not going to reprint it. Okay, maybe there's some legal reason behind it. But if I recall, I thought the reason that I saw on a comment thread was financial. But the question is, how do you know that? I mean, these decisions get made all the time. Well, this game just doesn't sell. It's not worth reprinting. Okay, maybe it's not selling a lot when it's continuously in stock, but 3 years down the road, would 500, 800, 1,000 people, would enough people be interested in? How do you know? See, GMT always knows.
It's kind of like a roll-your-own Kickstarter, because in Kickstarter, you're guaranteed that audience who has pledged the money for you, and that's its own problem, but, you know, it's kind of that same idea. If 1,000 of you guys are really interested about this, give us the money, we'll make it happen.
Right.
And they can.
Right.
They could do that. It's just a lot of work. And if that's not your main model, I can see how you wouldn't be interested in that. But, yeah, it's a cool idea.
About Space Empires, Talon, and now Dominant Species off the P500 and a number of other GMT games, just sort of from other retailers too. But highly recommend you check the company out if you haven't taken a good look at them. What kind of recent plays do we have going, or have we had going lately, Andrew?
Okay. I have been playing Not Alone, which is a first-time game.
I know. You've been playing with lots of people.
Ghislaine Masson. This is a game by Stronghold Games, and it's a one-versus-many co-op. All of you but one are these explorers, and you have crash-landed on an alien planet, the planet of Artipia, and you need to escape.
Coincidentally, that's the name of a publishing company.
You need to escape, because the planet is alive and it is trying to eat you. And this is what the remaining player does. They play as the beast of Artipia. Now, this is the type of game that really just grabs my eye as soon as I look at it, because I love the cat and mouse mechanic of one versus many, especially in Not Alone, because the one beast has all of the power and they actually have to move their marker relative to the other team less. They have less to do and they have more power, but there are more of the survivors. And so the beast is trying.
So you see where the beast is.
So the way it works is everyone has a hand of location cards, 1 through 5, and each person decides where they're going to go. And they can talk about it as long as they talk about it audibly so that the beast can hear. And after they had played their cards face down, the beast then decides where he is going to go, and he places some tokens on the map. Then the explorers flip over their cards, and if they are in the same location as the beast, they are caught, and the beast gets to move his assimilation tracker by 1, and he's trying to get to the middle of the board. If they do not get caught by the beast, then they can do the power on that card. So it's this interesting cat and mouse of, I really need to do that power, but maybe he knows that I need to do that power, so maybe I should do a power that's less helpful for me in the hopes of, you know, trying to just evade him. And then, oh, to make matters worse, the beast has these hunt cards that let him break the rules of the game at different phases. So maybe after the players have laid down their cards, he can force any one player to show him all but 2 of their cards in hand so that he knows, you know, 1 in 3 chance where they went. And
so there's some bluffing going on.
There is a whole lot of bluffing, because here's the thing. The hunted only have to survive because their marker moves after every round. And they have further to go, but their marker will certainly move every turn, whereas the beast's will only move if he catches someone. So it's actually in the hunted's interest to kind of stick to the less favorable locations, maybe stay away from the ones that they'd be expected to go to, because they just have to outlast this thing until rescue comes. It's this really, really interesting bluffing game. And man, it's just so sharp. I sat down and played this with strangers, and we had a great time.
So let me tell you one of my embarrassments as a board game reviewer.
Okay.
I have never played, even though I am sitting on several of them in my collection, I have never played the one versus many, like, hidden movement sort of game. Fury of Dracula, which I have and haven't played. Spectre Ops, same thing. Letters from Whitechapel, I think, is one of these. Mr. Jack. I've not played these kinds of games.
Now, this is a little different.
I can't really tell you how, and that's what I'm asking. How does this set itself apart from those others?
This is different because where those have a pretty big map and the one is always somewhere on the map and he'll move, but it's possible for the many to close in on him and catch him, you know, like in Fury of Dracula. In this one, you just have an abstracted grid of five cards. And every turn, the hunted will play down a card. But like in Century Spice Road, once you've played a card, you can't pick it up again immediately. You have to spend something to do that. So you start with only five location cards and you're spending them. So every turn you'll be at a different place, and the beast can go anywhere he wants on the whole map of 10 spaces. So the beast just chooses based on what's out in people's discard piles and stuff, where they're likely to go, what power they need to trigger, where am I going to put this beast token?
So the smallness of the map really draws out sort of that double blind bluff. And are you guys making these decisions, like, do you reveal at the same time? Like, does the beast reveal his...
No. The players play down their cards. Then the beast puts his token out visibly on the map after they've already played it and they can't change it. And then they have to flip it over and show him if he guessed right. So they get to look and watch him, like, think about where he's going to go, maybe hover the token over two different places to try to elicit a reaction from them. And he just gets to toy with them and say, oh, maybe I'll go to two.
But it is double blind because it doesn't get flipped until he plays, right? Their moves don't get flipped.
Their moves don't get flipped until after he's played.
Gotcha.
So he doesn't know where they are, but he gets to kind of tease them because he can go anywhere on the board and say, oh, maybe I'll go to one. And they've already played their card and they know that it's a one, but they're trying to just look their neck natural. But then he goes, oh, no, I think you're going to five. And he puts it on five. And then you go, yes, ha-ha, I was on one the whole time. Really good. And here's the part that I really appreciate about the game. There are actually 10 locations, but you only start with five in your hand. So you start with one through five. Six through 10 are out on the board. But to get to them, you have to go to five, which is the rover. And the rover lets you pick up any one location card and add it to your hand. So maybe I could pick up the seven. Now, all of a sudden, I can go to seven, where none of the other players can. And so the game starts out really tight with only five locations. And the beast is catching people. And he's really trying to camp out.
Is the rover a location that he can go to?
Yes.
Why would he not just spam that at the
beginning? Aha! Because number one is the beast's lair. And if you go to the lair and are not caught, you can copy wherever the beast is. So there's this really tense game. And what happens is the beast will be catching people. And then inevitably two or three people just make it through and they get into the rover. And then the game blows up because now you have way more locations. And the beast rockets up and he's so close to his destination. And remember, the survivors, their token is only moving once per turn, very slowly. But he'll burst up and he'll be so close to the goal. And their token will just keep moving. And inevitably, on the very last turn, both sides are one space away from victory. This game is perfectly balanced. It has a wonderful ebb and flow to it. And both sides are there, and the beast knows, if I can just catch one person of the four sitting around this table, I will win this game, because the beast token moves during the turn, and the survivor token moves at the end of the turn. And so the survivors are sitting there thinking, if none of us get caught, you know, we can barely eke out a win here. We were playing once, and Evan was the beast, and he was locked in this one-on-one battle with me. And I had two of the extra cards, and I was looking at them, and he was just staring at me the entire time, paying no attention to the other three players. And he's looking at me, and he's just daring me to go to this one place. And I ended up going somewhere completely different, and he didn't catch me. But he did catch Alicia. Alicia had ended up going to that place. And so he was locked in this battle with me, and then somehow he guessed wrong on me, and yet he managed to catch Alicia, and he won the game in that last turn, and we were one away, and we were so disappointed. But it was so good. It was so tense. And
okay, is it player elimination, though?
No. Each time you are caught, the beast gets to move the assimilation tracker forward.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, but you're not eliminated from the game.
You're never eliminated. You keep playing.
Gotcha.
It was just that in that specific case, we are on the very last turn of the game, because if he caught one of us, he would move on to the victory space. So that is my not review of Not Alone. I talked about this game way too long. I'm going to review it soon.
So I'm going to bring up a game that this is clearly the late to the party first play. And to be fair, it's not a first play. It's the first play that I got this game. I've played this game before, 2 years ago, Summoner Wars, and I didn't get it. Part of the problem was I played with a very experienced player. He was blowing me out of the water. And I didn't understand how to play the game. And I saw some elements to the game that just turned me off initially, that when I played it recently, I understood why they're there and why they work. So here's what I would recommend. If you have never played Summoner Wars, it's pretty easy to find a lot of the Summoner Wars product on clearance. And I found a whole bunch of it super cheap recently. And that caused me to sort of invest in it, thinking, well, I could just resell it. If I don't like it, I'm not going to resell it. Here's what I learned about Summoner Wars. Now, for those of you who don't know this game, it's almost like a miniatures war game with cards instead of miniatures. So
interesting.
It has the concept almost looks dorky at first because you're placing cards out on the table and moving them like chess pieces or moving them like like miniatures. And it's just a rectangle board with rectangle. So it's not even, fancy hex tiles or anything like that. And it just looks almost too simplistic at first. But you have to control like the spatial element of this is like how this piece moves and whether it has a ranged attack or a hand attack, a melee attack. You have to control the magic that you use to summon the creatures from your hand. And the way that you get magic is you either kill other creatures or at the end of your turn, you dump cards from your hand into your magic pile, and they're worth a magic point each. They're permanently dumped. You will never get them back.
Interesting.
When you're out of your draw pile, you're done. I hated that about the game. I'm the kind of guy, when I go through a video game, I want to play every single level, find every single one of its secrets. Right. When I play, one of my problems in these kinds of card games is not willing to let the card go out of my hand. And this game made me do something very, very uncomfortable. To look at a hand of cards and say, I've got 5 great cards here, and I'm going to dump 3 of them, and they're going to be gone from the game.
Right.
And I'm not going to get them back. But that's...
Wow, that's harsh.
That's the delicious part of the game, because once you understand a deck and how it's meant to work, you know what you can sacrifice to be able to play the things you need. It forces you into these decisions that then bring more cards into your hand and cycles your deck, because if you sit on those cards, what happens? You're going to have to really hope that you gain some magic by being able to beat something with the cards you have out to gain magic from killing the other player. So I kind of, this is taking a little bit longer to explain than I'd hoped. The point is, I love that decision now where I hated it before.
The 180.
It's delicious. It's tense. And you're not going to reshuffle your deck. And so the game is going to be over in about 15 minutes. And that's the other thing I like. I love the time of the game. Now, we played Phoenix Elves, Tundra Orcs, and Jungle Elves as well. And all three of those factions we found just worked really well against each other.
Interesting.
Evan won a couple. I won a couple. And we kind of left it at a draw. And it was sort of like, wow. Both of us just sat back and said, man, this game is a whole lot better than we had expected it to be. And I think this is one of those games that really holds up over time. And if you've not invested in Summoner Wars, I really would advise you to check it out before it sort of leaves the production cycle. Although I can't imagine them giving it up on it completely. Oh, by the way, the other thing I didn't like about it, and I'm picky about my dice-based combat. I like dice-based combat that gives you something, and it's not just all or nothing. This is all or nothing. But it's okay because it's a one or two misses and everything else hits. So it pretty much evens out over the game. And it's just something that you have to learn to sort of expect. And when you make your moves, you have to think about it.
If I sound distracted while you're talking, it's because I've been looking at pictures of the game. It actually has a pretty cool look to it.
It does.
It stirs my... this will offend you, but it stirs my inner abstract lover to see that grid of cards out there.
But see, I think you would like it as an abstract game.
Right. No, the mechanics look interesting enough that I would play it. The medieval fantasy does absolutely nothing for me. But the mechanics do look really cool.
But see, the medieval fantasy works for me because it's not generic.
Uh-huh.
I mean, like Tundra Orcs. They put like these interesting settings, like the jungle elves. I've never seen anything that looked like that, you know? And so they've managed to put a spin on it that isn't, it really sort of feels thematic. It's as you play it, it sort of feels like, wow, I wish they kind of made some, interesting comic books or lore. Maybe they have, and I'm not aware of it. The only thing I kind of wish is that the big sort of parchment paper fold-out
board for it is,
yeah, I've already been looking today on where I can get a decent neoprene.
I'm sure they exist, right?
I'm sure they exist. I really want to get one. I'm so glad that I bought this when I found it on sale. I would encourage people to look out for to look out for this game. And even if you just want to try it out, get one of these little I don't know what they call it. So they had like this core box that had, I don't know how many factions it had in it because I didn't buy it, but they have these other smaller boxes that just have two factions in it, the board, everything you need to play. It's just that it only has the two factions in it. And it's an inexpensive way to try the game, see sure. if you like it. Maybe head down to your friendly local game store, see if somebody's got a copy. I'm sure you'll find people who love to play this game. This is just one of those games that it went from my... had I not bought this recently, it would have been on a list of games that I just don't get. I just don't get why people like it. Am I the only one that doesn't like it? And I see it now. So I'm very, very pleased, actually, to have made that. And, you know, we've talked about how an abstract game, you kind of need to see it. I'm finding it, too, and I think Evan and I talked about this, too. We're not going to, even though I bought, like, about 30 factions at once, we are going to actually sort of play them slowly.
Yeah.
Because it's...
That's what you have to do.
It's really important to know how each faction plays against each other.
That's how I prefer to play Smash Up.
Right.
Just kind of learn one faction at a time, plod through the content. There's a lot of content in these types of games.
Right.
Well, great. I know we say that our first impressions aren't actually reviews, but we kind of just gave you two mini reviews there of games that we've played more than a couple times mm-hmm. that we both really enjoyed. Neither of us has played the one that the other talked about, so there's some mini reviews for you for this week to tide you over. So next week, we're going to be discussing a little bit about how we can host game nights, how you gauge success there, and just kind of what it looks like to have people in your house. Tune in next week for that. People can be unpredictable, so you'll want to hear our super secret cool tips. This has been Get On Board. As always, you can find us on the web at www.getonboard.games. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play Music, Board Game Geek. Check out our guild for any discussion on this week's podcast. And tune in next Monday for our next episode. I'm Andrew.
I'm Tim.
And you've been listening to Get On Board.